The next case of the morning is number 02-1823, Diego Gill against James Reed et al.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Ellen Stanfield, and I represent the appellant, Diego Gill. The District Court abused its discretion in its September 21, 2001 order denying Gill's request for the assistance of counsel. Because that order should be reversed, the summary judgment must be vacated and the case remanded with instructions to appoint counsel for Gill. The court applied an incorrect legal standard when considering Gill's final request for an attorney. Instead of asking if Gill was competent to try the case, in light of the particular complexities and difficulties of the case, and if not, whether the presence of an attorney would have made a difference in the outcome, instead, the court denied his request solely because the attorneys whom he was able to reach from prison declined to take his case.
I was just going to say, you're essentially asking us, though, to disregard the district court's first order in which she had said, and here's the rest of the analysis. I read her second order simply saying that nothing had convinced her to revisit that earlier decision, not as some rigid, you know, if you can't get it in the market, you're not entitled to it anyway sort of approach.
Your Honor, the court's first order denied Gill's request because he hadn't met the threshold requirement of trying unsuccessfully to find an attorney on his own.
Right.
She did cite Farmer v. Hotz, which lays out the standard, but she didn't apply it.
Well, she did apply it. She went through it in some detail, and then she...
Your Honor, in that order, which Gill is not appealing, the court held that he hadn't met the threshold requirement of finding an attorney, and she then cited the standard she would have applied had he not. In the second order, she merely recognized that she had denied his request before. She didn't apply the standard.
You know, you argued that to the extent of Mr. Gill was required to provide expert opinion, he was entitled under Wisconsin law to use the defendant's admissions during discovery to supply the evidence. What admissions were made during discovery that would have relieved him of the need to provide expert opinion?
Your Honor, the argument actually is that he should have been able to rely on evidence that he obtained from his treating doctors, one of whom was not a defendant, was Dr. Kim, as well as potential testimony of the defendant.
But we don't have an affidavit from Dr. Kim who
we don't have to
speculate might say, I gave orders for a certain course of treatment and Dr. Reed disregarded them.
We don't have an affidavit, Your Honor, but there is evidence in the record obtained from Dr. Kim that shows that he didn't believe that Dr. Reed and the medical staff at Oxford met the requisite standard of care. Actually, an attorney would have been able to point this out to the court to defeat the summary judgment motion, but Gill simply wasn't competent.
Well, let's move on if we may pass this test issue.
Okay.
And let's assume that Judge Crabb did use the prevailing test. Did she still abuse the discretion?
Yes, Your Honor.
And if so, why?
Yes, Your Honor. Even if this court finds that she applied the correct standard, her holding denying Gill's request for counsel was still an abuse of discretion. In light of the complexities of this particular case, Gill clearly wasn't competent to try the case without the assistance of an attorney. This wasn't a run-of-the-mill prisoner litigation case. There was no debate about the facts. There was no swearing contest over what happened. Notably, the defendants don't deny Gill's version of the facts. Instead, the case turned on complex and subtle issues of law and procedural pitfalls that Gill was unable to overcome.
Are they complex issues of law, or are they complex issues about, on the Federal Tort Claims Act branch of the case, what the floor is for the standard of medical care that would be acceptable, and whether Dr. Reed fell below it? Laypersons might not know exactly when you do Tylenol 3 or when you do Motrin or when you do other sorts of things. I mean, it seems to me it is a case that cries out for expert testimony, both on the Federal Tort Claims Act branch and possibly even on the Eighth Amendment branch.
Your Honor, an attorney would have been able to show the court, Gill simply wasn't able to, that there was evidence in the record obtained from Dr. Kim that he didn't believe that Dr. Gill met the requisite standard of care.
Dr. Reed, yeah.
After the second rectal prolapse surgery in 2000, which Dr. Kim performed, he prescribed a very specific course of treatment that included, among other medications, Vicodin. After he learned that the prison medical staff didn't follow this prescription, instead giving him a pain reliever that not only didn't relieve pain, but that exacerbated his condition and caused internal and external bleeding, and imposed a risk of the rectal prolapse returning, causing the surgery to be a failure.
Well, but isn't part of your argument that anybody who claims to call himself a doctor ought to know that the presence of codeine in a painkiller is going to constipate? I mean, let's get...
Well, no, Your Honor, that's not my argument right now. My argument...
It could be.
My argument now is that Dr. Kim provided evidence in the record that showed that he believed that Dr. Reed's treatment didn't meet the standard of care. After Gill went back to Dr. Kim, after 10 days of suffering the consequences of the prison staff not following his prescription, Dr. Kim rewrote that prescription, underscoring the need for the medication that he had originally prescribed, including Vicodin, a non-Tylenol 3 pain reliever. And he even wrote a note on the prescription to send back with Gill to the prison that said, in shorthand, please follow these instructions. Patient needs this medication.
You know, the defendants argue that Mr. Gill didn't raise below his argument that lack of a medical expert is irrelevant to a common negligence claim. Is that correct? Was that waived?
No, Your Honor, it wasn't waived. Mr. Gill sufficiently alleged not only medical malpractice in his complaint, but also common law negligence under Wisconsin law. He was unable to separate the claims to the court, which is just further evidence that he wasn't competent to try this claim on his own. But an attorney would have been able to show that in Wisconsin, the failure to provide prompt, adequate medical care states a claim for general negligence.
I have one other quick question for you. I don't want to use up your rebuttal.
Okay.
Has he abandoned his FTCA claim for acts occurring before his transfer to FCI Oxford, as the defendants have suggested in a footnote?
Yes.
Footnote 7.
Yes.
He has.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thanks.
I'd just like to continue with saying that in Wisconsin, a prison employee's failure to provide prompt medical assistance, an unreasonable denial or delay of medical care, states a claim for general negligence, which has no expertise requirement. He'll probably allege this in his complaint, although he wasn't able to explain to the court why summary judgment should be defeated on this basis. If there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Ms. Stanfield. We'll hear now from Mr. O'Connor.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Please, the Court. I'm Stephen O'Connor, Assistant U.S. Attorney from Madison, Wisconsin. I represent both the United States and the individual defendants in this case. There are three issues before the Court today. First, whether or not Judge Crabb abused her discretion in failing to appoint counsel for Mr. Gill on two different occasions. Secondly, whether district court properly granted summary judgment on the claim against the United States for failure of Mr. Gill to present any expert testimony with regard to his medical negligence claim, and third, whether or not she properly granted summary judgment on the two Bivens actions against physician assistant Penaflor and Dr. Reed.
I'd like to start with the third with you, if I might, please, because Mr. Gill has provided evidence that Penaflor angrily told him he couldn't have his prescribed antibiotic medication, and that the date on the bottle when Gill finally gets the medication was for the day before. Why isn't this enough to show that Penoplore acted with deliberate indifference? His withholding of a prescribed medication was willful under these facts, the way I view it, and caused another 12 hours of needless suffering. And boy, is that suffering.
Well, Your Honor, I think the answer to that question is that that is the only act in which there is any allegation that Mr. Penoplore did anything with regard to the treatment of Mr. Gill throughout his entire time at Oxford.
But there's no requirement of repeated acts. I mean, if Mr. Penoplore had strung him up on the ceiling for 12 hours and they said, oh, well, that's the only time, we would still say that was utterly inappropriate behavior.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So if he deprives him of a vital antibiotic, even in 12 hours, antibiotics can kick in and start making you feel better.
Well, as the court pointed out, and I think this court has held in Gutierrez, there is no an occasional lapse or occasional bit of negligence or occasional even malpractice does not rise to the level of constitutional.
No, it doesn't. But if you deliberately say, "I'm not going to give it to you," that's not negligence, right? He didn't negligently say that.
Your Honor, I don't believe that's what the record supports.
Mr. Gill alleged.
Well, Mr. Gill alleged that he's in a hostile tone. Did not deliver the medication.
Right. Why isn't a 12-hour delay in prescribed treatment, which appears to have occurred for no other reason than malice, why wouldn't that constitute a harm? I mean, undoubtedly it caused tremendous pain and discomfort.
It may have caused pain and discomfort, Your Honor, but to get beyond that, perhaps on the negligence point of view, we don't know that. We don't know whether or not after lancing that abscess and treating it that day, that there was any continuing harm by delaying delivery of the treatment by perhaps 10 hours at the outside to this man. Dr. Aslam, in his supporting affidavit in our reply on summary judgment, says it doesn't make any difference. What the medication is designed to do is not get rid of the infection. That was done by the lancing and cleaning of the wound. The medication is there to prevent further infection,
right,
which did not happen.
Well, but thank God. I mean, anyone who ever has had an infection understands the consequence of delaying antibiotics. This isn't a minor infection. This was related to a fresh surgical wound. I have to say, I'm very troubled by Reed's claim that Vicodin is not part of the BOP's national formulary, because that explains only why he couldn't provide Vicodin. But it doesn't at all explain why he would choose a constipating drug that the expert had specifically warned against when he had other choices such as Motrin. I mean, wouldn't that alone raise a fact question here?
Well, Your Honor, the Vicodin and Tylenol 3 are both designed to be very strong pain relief.
Yeah, but one is contraindicated for this particular surgery. A doctor should have known that.
Well, he did treat, he elected not to give, he couldn't give Vicodin.
He shows eventually that he can give Motrin. Nobody's criticizing him for not giving Vicodin. We understand that these rules are there. But he himself eventually switches to Motrin. And as Judge Ripple says, why, when you've had this particular kind of surgery, it's not like a broken arm that got set, this surgery, a constipating agent is appalling.
Your Honor, I would submit that that's a balancing. Do you give a man a medication that's going to treat the probably severe pain that he's suffering after that mucosal prolapse surgery, or do you give him an over-the-counter pain reliever? And
it won't at least defeat the purpose of the surgery. I mean, anyway, there are facts here all over the place. I want to just throw one last complication in before your time is up. And this is on the medical malpractice claim. It's unclear to me why a Wisconsin evidentiary rule should be binding in a federal court, even though the substantive law of Wisconsin on medical malpractice obviously applies, since that's where these events took place. I assume when the federal district court tries FTCA cases in Wisconsin, it follows the federal rules of evidence. And it uses, as we've repeatedly said, even in Erie cases, a federal standard as to when something is sufficient to submit to a jury. So just because Wisconsin has chosen to have a rule of thumb or a rigid rule, whatever you want to say, requiring expert testimony in all cases, it's not clear to me that this is something that carries over lock, stock, and barrel into the federal proceeding. It looks more procedural to me.
Well, Your Honor, we presented our motion for summary judgment based on the fact that there was not expert testimony to create a tribal issue of fact. The basic claim here is the substitution of Tylenol 3 for Vicodin. This court, a year ago, in a Illinois case, using pretty much the same standard, in fact, the Illinois case cited in that for the proposition that you cannot survive summary judgment absent expert testimony, is exactly the same language, or nearly exactly the same language used in the Wisconsin Supreme Court. I think it's in Christensen versus Downs. So there is no tribal issue of fact to get to the evidentiary question.
But we had Dr. Kim saying, don't use Tylenol 3, the expert. So there's some evidence that Tylenol 3 shouldn't be used. Maybe we lay people don't know precisely all of his reasons for saying that. We know there's a difference of opinion among doctors.
And a difference of an opinion does not rise to a level of medical negligence without somebody saying this opinion does not meet the standard of care in the community as it's practiced by Dr. Reed or the other practitioners in central Wisconsin.
Unless it's a universal truism that every medical student learns in their first year.
And we wouldn't know that without knowing that testimony from a medical expert, Your Honor. Unless the court has other questions, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. O'Connor. Stanfield, you have 2 minutes.
Your Honor, I'd like to make a couple final points. First, as Judge Wood pointed out, I believe it was since the case that the government is referring to, the Seventh Circuit has held that an expertise requirement that's more stringent under state law doesn't apply in a federal forum. It was a case called Euland. And I think that supports the position that Gill should have been able to defeat the summary judgment argument. Further, as far as Tenafloor's deliberate indifference, it's clear that he knew of the harm that Gill was suffering. He knew of the infection, and he knew of the risk of substantial harm that the failure to provide the medication could provide. It's obvious that the failure to provide an antibiotic for 12 hours causes the infection to remain for 12 hours longer than it otherwise would have. He deliberately ignored Gill's medical needs, even though the cost of giving him the medication was easy. He was holding the bottle in his hand. Finally, it's true that it would have been better to have a medical expert in this case, but there are facts all over the place that suggest that Gill shouldn't have been, this Gill's argument should have been able to defeat summary judgment. The summary judgment standard shouldn't be applied with strict literalness to a pro se incarcerated indigent plaintiff. He created a genuine issue of fact, both as to his FTCA claim and as to his Eighth Amendment allegations. If he had had an attorney represent him, it would have been easier to overcome this procedural hurdle of finding an expert witness or of showing the court that an independent expert witness wasn't necessary given the facts that were already in the record. For these reasons, the court's order denying him counsel should be reversed. But even if not, the summary judgment should be reversed and the case remanded for further proceedings. Unless there are any further questions, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Stanfield. Our thanks to both counsel in the case. Ms. Stanfield, we thank you and your law firm for taking this case on by appointment and for your service.